So thank you. So coming here, I looked at the title of the workshop and I didn't actually see the suffix. So I looked only at the prefix, saw locally decodable codes, started to think what experiences did I have with locally decodable codes. And actually I recall that they disappointed me a couple of times. So I thought I would tell you a little bit about those disappointments. So it's not quite, it's not all gloomy, it's not just disappointments. Some of them are, I think, are good open problems, and some of them are actually, I believe that they should be relevant to some extent. So actually, I'll try to compress in the hour and a half that I have. I'll try to compress. I'll try to tell you about three pieces of work. One with Guy Rothblum on online memory checking, on fault tolerant storage with Uri Nadav, and on the compressibility of NP instances with Danny Harmon. So the theme, as I said, is cases. The theme of this talk are cases where locally decodable codes should be helpful or seem to be helpful initially, but either provably were not helpful or they're an open problem. Okay, so the bulk of the talk, I guess, they will spend on this example, on the complexity of online memory checking. So the authentication problem, of course, is one of the basic problems addressed in cryptography. You have a large string, and you want to verify that it has not been modified. Lots and lots of variants of this problem. In our setting, we have a user who has a large file, who is residing on a remote server. The user has some small secret fingerprint, and he wants to detect corruption. And in general, if this is all I was telling you, if this is all there is to the problem, then we know that you can have good. You can have small fingerprints. We understand exactly what the requirements are. We don't need any computational assumption. It's all good, but. Here we're talking about, let's say we don't want to verify the whole file, we don't want to read the entire file, we just want to read a small part of it. And just think of, you want to just verify what you need. And the question is, how much of the file do you need to read in order to verify or authenticate, say, one bit, for instance? And how much of the file do you need to read, and how much, how large a fingerprint do you need to store secretly? So here is the model in more detail. The user makes a store and retrieve request to the memory. We think of the memory as a vector of length n under the adversary's control. We have a memory checker who sits in the middle between the user and the public memory and wants to verify that when you retrieve a bit, it's indeed the last value that was stored in that particular location. The checker has some space complexity SFN, makes its own reads and writes, and it has a query complexity of Q of A. And we want small s and small q. S is the secret space that the memory checker has, q is the query complexity.
So the memory checker has the fingerprint?
Yeah, the user is completely naive. He just says, I want to change this bit, I want to retrieve that bit, has no idea. The memory checker is completely trusted, and it has secret storage.
Yeah. Memory checker can modify the write query into the public. It can write something different than what the user asked.
This is completely under the control of the adversary. Okay, so the user makes a request store. The checker looks, consider the value that he got. He has some secret memory, and as a result, makes various. Up to Q requests to the public memory, and writes whatever you need to write there. Yeah.
There's no bound of the number of how much
absolutely no way.
Can you repeat the question?
He asked, is there a bound on the amount of corruption of the public memory? No, it's completely controlled by the adversary.
But if it's bad enough, you
won't retrieve. Right, right. We'll see the requirements. Okay, so here retrieve again, reads writes up to Q places. I'm not distinguishing here between the read complexity and the write complexity. Let's take both of them to be Q. And then retrieves bit B. And the adversary controls both the public memory, so it has complete control over the public memory here. No secret, both in terms of secrecy and in terms of the contents. It can retrieve anything, can give back anything to you. And it also controls not the user itself, but the stream of requests that the user is making. So the adversary controls both these things. Okay. And what is that we want? What are the requirements that we want to be satisfied? We want for any sequence of users' requests and any responses from the public memory. Well, first we want completeness. If for every read from the public memory equals the last write, that is, the public memory functions as the public memory should, then you get then the user gets back his correct bit. So we haven't heard anything, we're just not telling you where it acts as it should be. Either perfect completeness or hyperability completeness. And then we want soundness. So if some read from the public memory is not equal to the last write of that particular bit, then if this is the case, if this happens, so something happened here, obviously something, he was cheating something somewhere in the public memory. If this happens, then the guarantee the user has is that he gets either, if any of this stuff here is incorrect, then either he gets the correct bit, so there was somehow magically a correction, but we're not guaranteeing anything but correction, or he gets the memory is buggy. So he gets a warning sign, the memory is buggy. Okay, so in case there are problems with the public memory, we're not required to detect them, but we are not allowed, we as the memory checkers, are not allowed to return a false value. Yeah?
Information directly?
Okay, we'll get to that, please.
So this, every read and every write, that's a read and write by the memory checker to the public memory? In your definition of completeness? If every read from public memory equal, doesn't it?
If the public memory is completely, functional.
If I have a memory checker that never reads or writes anything and always answers bug, that would answer your thing.
No.
Because the read.
Oh, because it doesn't even read or write.
Exactly.
But,
or do you want
to
so in terms of what the user asks?
Yeah, okay. So let's add that. So. If it never makes any read and write and answers, but you're right, yeah.
Okay. I don't know,
maybe it only does work when you're reading and writing, in which case it did too, and we'll just say fun.
I should say, if there are no errors, well, it's a question exactly how you read if every read.
Yeah, that's why I am. You need some
completeness in, come on. I mean, are you asking it to know, or are you asking it to point a problem?
The
problem here. Obviously, if it's functional, you want to get back the answer. Or otherwise, you don't want. You either, if it's not functional, if there is a problem, you either answer you give back the correct answer, or you're allowed to say it's buggy.
Just maybe to connect it to this thing. So. Does it make sense to add the robustness required, meaning that if the public memory, corrupts only a constant fraction of your database, bug is impossible, so denial of service is kind of impossible? Because here you're saying...
No, I'm not. Denial of service, this definition certainly allows, for it has no correction requirement. You can either correct it, you're allowed to correct it if you can, or you're allowed to say buggy. I'm not saying which. You're not allowed to answer with the false value.
Okay. I'm just saying it may be a solution already satisfied with very limited thing. You might want to add maybe a robustness requirement saying, you know, if actually the memory is not totally corrupted, you get functionality, it's impossible to get.
Yeah, okay, you could compose it conceivably, probably you could compose it with locally decodable stuff, so maybe it is not a false promise. But the requirement here is there is no correction required. So you don't have to correct things. You are allowed to say it's buggy. Okay, this is the problem. So these are the requirements. So what is known? I guess this model was suggested. Blumen, Skimmel, Sobotkan, and me. And in that paper, we showed offline memory checkers that detect errors only at the end of the request sequence. That's one model we considered there. And there, actually, we have a very good solution. You have Q of n, which is order one. That's Q is the number of queries. You have to write just order one, actually one in this case, slightly. You write whatever you have to write plus a tag. And the secret memory is log n or log n plus log the error that you want. And you no crypto assumptions. So again, this is offline versus online. Offline means that at the end of the sequence, you know that the bug occurred, you don't know where the bug occurred. Okay, this is the offline case. So here we have very good in terms of SMQ, more or less as best as you want. In fact, they are optimal, you can't have better than that. And what Miki Aitai showed a couple of years ago is that the memory has to be invasive. You cannot store the public memory, you cannot simply store whatever you wanted it to be. Let's say if without the fact that you have to add tags or something like that. The problem is the replay. And so he provably shows that the memory, you cannot write exactly you have to increase a little bit the memory.
I don't understand what invasive is.
Invasive means that the public memory isn't exactly the file. The simplest model you can imagine is that you write in the public memory exactly the file. So he showed that you have to make changes, you have to essentially have to add tags. So this is for the offline, so good. So the question is, can we match the offline performance for the online? Okay. So for online memory checkers, under the assumption that one-way functions exist, one can consider two possible ways to go. Either use pseudorandom functions as tags and get it, or use it as universal one-way hash functions. And there you get pretty good performance. You get Q of n is logarithmic. You have to retrieve logarithmic number of words. And SFN, you have to store something proportional to the security parameter, for instance, a key to a pseudorandom function.
So we assume that that verse means
then you have to give definitions of computation limitations on the adversary, of course, for if you have a new computation.
So the SFN is actually going to be k or something like that? So if your aim was super exponential, you could do.
S of n, I mean, I always hesitate how to write it. S of n is the seed, think of it as a seed of a pseudorandom functions. Okay. And the question is, are they really necessary? Do you need them? Because we saw that for the offline case, you don't need computational assumptions. And so do you need them? What can you do if you don't have computational assumptions? And okay, so here's something pretty simple you can do. A Q of n for anything you want, and S of n would be n over Q of n. How would you do it? Work in chunks, essentially, and authenticate each separately. You can use the same secret function, essentially.
Why can't you use a
Merkle hash? No, you don't want
to connect to the
complexity. Here?
I mean,
or in the which
so in the computational setting, can you
use
assumptions?
No. You I say there are two ways to go. Either use I can think of two protocols.
That's fine.
Either use YOFS, or by the way, in this context, you shouldn't call them Merkle hashes. You should call them Wegman-Carter trees. Merkle trees. You should call them Merkle-Carter. Wegman-Carter trees. Wegman and Carter. I mean, what is the so Right, so there are two ways to go here. Yeah, this is the case. Okay. So you can get, so what you can get is if query complexity, any query complexity, but then the storage complexity is n over q. So you get that the product of s and q is order n.
How do you do that? So
you essentially work in chunks. And you think when you want to access something in a given chunk, you read everything there and verify.
Oh, okay.
But then there's no tree. So where does the tree come?
That tree came from Jonathan's question.
Any elaboration on that?
No, it's related to the left part. He was behind.
Okay.
Is it necessary to spend Hogan computational thing, or we don't?
That's a good question. This is one of the open problems. So let's tell you about another problem, which is even simpler, and will probably require fewer queries from the audience to understand. So what if the only thing you want to do is testability? We don't actually want to retrieve anything yet. So here, you want to encode a file. And it will have a large public encoding, as before, and it will have a secret encoding, as before, which is going to be SFN. And it will have a decoding algorithm, but now the decoding algorithm will be a global one. It will take the public file and, let's say, the secret thing, and will produce will retrieve the original vector. So there is absolutely no local decoding. It's just the global thing. And what we want to do is we'll have a consistency verifier who will repeatedly probe the public encoding and check that you can indeed decode it. So the way it would do is it would simply look at it at various locations, check whether it was significantly corrupted, reading, let's say, T of n bits, and would want to output whether wants to output whether it was corrupted or not corrupted. So the requirements are that if it says that it wasn't corrupted, then with high probability or with reasonably high probability, the decoder can retrieve the original file. And the completeness requirement for TAL are that if it's not corrupted at all. It's not corrupted at all, then it has to say that it wasn't corrupted. Okay, so if it's corrupted, it has two possibilities. Either say, if it's corrupted, then we're assured that either it says corrupted, or the decoding algorithm will be able to decode it nevertheless. Okay? Even simpler than memory checking. And you can have, here it's easier. Here you don't need a tree, actually. That's the advantage here. You don't need a tree. There are absolutely no trees here. You can get a pretty good authentication with computational assumptions. And there is a clear connection to coding here. You start with a good error correcting code. And actually, erasure correcting code is what you need. Take whatever you want. Read Solomon, or maybe, I don't know if you don't like to work over large fields, then use Hadid, then use one of the more modern ones. And the property, of course, is as long as a certain fraction of the symbols is available, you want to be able to decode X. And what you do is you simply add to each symbol a tag, which is a pseudorandom function of the secret key, and the symbol and the location, let's say. And what the verifier does is it picks a location at random, reads the symbol and the tag, and verifies that it's okay. And if many tags were corrupted, then if it detected a corrupted tag, it says buggy. And if not, it says okay. And if many of the symbols were corrupted, so what the decoding process does is first removes all the inappropriate tags, and then decodes using the erase your corrected code. And if you, there were many, if there were many tags which were corrupted, then with reasonable, then this step that will be detected with reasonably high probability, and otherwise you'll be able to correct. So this is a pretty good authenticator according to a definition, except that we are using Serrano function, we're using computational assumptions, we're assuming that the adversary is limited. Okay, so this, what's the connection between the problems? If you have a memory checker, then you have an authenticator with the same complexity. Okay, if you have a memory checker with space complexity S of n and query complexity T of n, then you have an authenticator with similar performance. The idea is to use a high distance code. And originally, when we started thinking of it, we thought it probably there may be a reduction the other way. Actually, now I'm not sure whether there is a reduction the other way, or whether you can go from authenticators to memory checkers. But let's think of authenticators. It's really what sounds a lot like the stuff, all the excitement that we've been having in the last 10 or 15 years, all the locally decodable codes, locally testable codes. Actually, PCPs of proximity sound very similar to that. Okay. Because PCPs of proximity allow you to check whether you're close to a code word. So are they a solution to the problem of authenticator? I mean, if it's close to a code word, and the code word, you know, you will be able to, then the code is good, so you'll be able to decode. So are PCPs of proximity actually a solution to the problem? You have the proof. You take the thing, you have the proof. This is the encoding. Does it solve it? No, because the problem is what the proof is that you're close to a code word, not the code word. So you don't know that you know that you will retrieve something, but you don't know that it will be the original thing. So
then can't you just check it on a random location and say that
it's the same?
Something like that. You just check some consistency randomly and then check it first.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Apparently not, because it's just, this is exactly where it misled us. So any online memory checker, which is secure, which is against computational unbounded, adversary has this performance, the space times the number of queries I'm switching against between Q and T, they're essentially the same. Space times the number of queries is omega of n for an online, unlike offline, remember, which was way too more efficient. Here, you need space times n, space times q, space times number of queries is omega of n. And it's true also for authenticators. In fact, we prove it through authenticators. We prove the lower bound on authenticators. And then derive it to online. So you can see now why it's less relevant whether you can reduce it to the other direction, where if you have a good authenticator, you also have a memory checker with it. Because you have neither of them, essentially. Neither is better than the naive thing, relatively naive thing of cutting it into chunks. So that's one thing. And in fact, you can actually show that that you need one-way functions precisely. If there exists an online memory checker working in polynomial time, secure against polynomial time adversary with query complexity, which is better than where the product of the space complexity times the query complexity is less than some specific constant times n, then there exist functions that are hard to invert on infinitely many input lengths. In other words, you have almost one-way functions. It's related to Yuval's comment sometimes. Maybe there will be regions where one-way functions exist, maybe there will be regions where they don't exist.
And how does the C appear in the...
It's a concrete constant, some specific constant. You can compute from the proof.
But it's independent of the security part.
There exists a number, let's say one-fifth.
So some monitor just about the PCP. I thought maybe I don't understand regard requirement of indicators, but if you're close to a code word, you know the decoding will succeed. I mean, we have some.
But it would give you the wrong code word. It will succeed.
What is right? What is right?
That one you stored.
You won't store it.
But I'm allowed to corrupt anything I want. I mean, there is no bound on the number of. Parameters.
Right. So, so what I want. Right.
Oh, secret memory.
Okay,
so what was the almost one-way function?
Almost one-way function means that for infinitely many, on infinite many input lengths, it acts as a one-way function. Okay, because you can never, it's always problematic to give type, I mean,
for every end, you can do it for the less than C end, and then you'll have it for every end.
No.
If you assume that the E for every end.
Unfortunately not. Bit trickier than that. It's the proof unfortunately doesn't quite work like that.
And what do we know about this assumption? Almost one way function. Does it imply anything you could know?
Well, for the lengths where the one way functions exist, everything you know would work.
How sparse could they get those lengths? Could they get ridiculously sparse?
Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, it's not a particularly new assumption. It's just spelled out here. Most papers that prove things actually prove it prove almost one-way function. I think that Ostrov Kvikduzin says something like, "From now on, we'll call almost one-way function a one-way function."
Well, if you have an infinite sequence of lengths, then it's a bona fide one-way function, right? Even if
you
the sequence
live, if you live, if
is exponentially
if
far apart.
If you live in this yeah. world, in these ends, where you have one-way.
I mean, you can imagine that for certain lengths of inputs, factoring is easy, and for others it's hard. So this could be spaced in a funny way. So then you have one-way functions for those inputs where factoring is hard, and no one-way functions for those inputs where factoring is easier. So this is
okay. So I'm not going to say much about the proof. I just say that the initial insight with the connection to the simultaneous message model, which I'm just pointing it out, maybe it will be useful for proving the things on locally decodable codes. The simultaneous message protocol model was actually in the originally our paper on communication complexity, already described. The difference here is not Alice and Bob do not communicate directly, so each one of them has an input. Each one of them has an input, perhaps chosen adversarially or mischievously, and they want to compute the function of their two inputs, but they're not communicating directly. They're each sending a message to Carol. Perhaps they also have some coins, but not common coins. Or if they do have common coins, then the adversary knows them. So they're sending they're each sending a message to Carol, and Carol, based on the message it receives, computes the function. So this is the simultaneous message. Alice and Bob do not simply send it to Carol, who tells them, who computes the function. Of course, they could send the full string, but the question is how little information can be sent, how small can the communication be? And the interesting function here is the equality function. And actually, there is a slightly non-trivial protocol for equality function, which does something, which essentially has communication square in on Alice and Bob, and there are the lower bounds are that the first lower bound was proved by Lenin and Segedi. They show that the sum is optimal in the sense that the length of the messages has to be square root n. But actually, a later proof showed that the product of the two messages is omega of n. And this is, it's not a mistake that the product, and remember that we have s times S times Q, we wanted it to be n. It's roughly the same thing here. So we relied on this on the ideas from that protocol to derive a lower bound.
Mm-hmm.
This is information theoretical. Right, it's actually a pretty good, you can define a model here, not quite with these pictures, where computational protocol, in terms of communication, beat the communication complexity. Essentially, if they had, if they didn't have common bits, but the adversary knew them, for instance, then they could use it to have a collision attractive hash function. And then you'll have you'll have short communication. So it's a case where critical beats combinatorics. Okay, so this is, I'm not going to say anything about the proof. It turns out to be fairly involved and not clear how you could simplify these things. Particular turns out to be related to some learning problem, learning adaptively changing distributions. Okay, so what's the conclusion for online memory checking in LDCs? We settle the complexity of online memory checking, but LDCs fail us. So the interesting open problems is what Yevgeny was mentioning. Do you really need logarithmic complexity for online memory checking with computational assumptions? Because it's a bit cumbersome. You have a tree anyway. Whether you use the hash way or whether you go the sort of random way, you have a tree anyway. No matter what you call it, maybe let's call it a Jonathan Katz tree. Okay, the general question of the relationship between crypto and complexity object, and I don't know, I guess it's appropriate for this workshop to ask about quantum memory checkers. I'm not sure where they are.
Where do you put the parentheses? Quantum memory checkers or quantum memory checkers?
I think, let's find, you know, maybe authenticators would be easier, slightly easier. I'm not sure, actually, both of them make sense. Your question is completely where to put it? Is it quantum memory checkers or quantum memory checkers?
So, physically, it's easier.
Yeah, I think it's. Okay. So, let's see. Let me just, not even use any of the slides, just mention the problem dealt here is fighting censorship. So you have...
So this, what you already talked about, is this a case where it's probably not helpful?
Yeah.
This or an open problem?
No, this...
The one you talked about.
This one, probably not helpful.
So what does it mean? Like, what is the statement?
Because of the lower bound.
Oh, I see.
Because of the lower bound, it's probably not helpful. So here, what you want to do is you want to be able to have a system where anyone can store a file in various servers. It's a completely distributed system. You want to be able to store a file on various servers. Now, the adversary is a censoring adversary. Think of, your favorite government or the RIAA. So they're going to take control of some of the servers, and let's say just take them offline for simplicity. It could be even, could also be Byzantine, but for simplicity, think that they are just taking them offline. And you want users, readers, to be able to retrieve the file, even though some of the servers were decommissioned. So the question is, what can you do? And in general, in terms of the measures of quality, you can ask similar questions. The read-write complexity, how much does it take to read, how much does it take to write, number of rounds, and the blow-up ratio. I mean, obviously, you can send store this, the file on all the servers in the world, and as long as the as long as there is some island nation where the RIA has reached it, you'll be able to retrieve it. So, but obviously this is not particularly desirable. And there are clear connections to LDC here. I mean, this is not a false promise, this is true. If you're willing to have a high write complexity, rewrite all your all the storage in the world whenever you write something, then even if the RIAA controls a constant fraction of the disks, you'll be able to retrieve the files. And some of the LDCs, for instance, the ones that they mentioned, the remover codes, should be doable here. But of course, the big problem is that you have a huge write complexity whenever you want to store a file. And there are ways, there are other ways, the different ways to pick square root n servers at random, store your file there in full, and whenever you want to read, you pick square root n servers and read from them, asking, do you have this file, do you have this file, etc. And from the birthday paradox, we know that they're going to intersect, and therefore you'll be able to retrieve the file. On the other hand, an adversary who wants to delete your file has to pretty much scan all the list until he deletes everything there. So you have something pretty good there. But of course, the problem is large read-write complexity and the high blow-up ratio. And in fact, if the readers are non-adaptive, if you do not adapt as you read along, then you cannot be resilient to theta n faults with better complexity than I just described. So the product of the read complexity and write complexity has to be omega n, and the blow pressure has to be square root n. But this is if you're not adaptive, you do not decide where to write as you go, as based on the information that is already there. So this is really the open problem. So what happens to the lower bounds, or the better upper bounds when the reading can be adaptive? Both the reading and the adversary are adaptive. So the adversary can control at most, let's say, 10% of the servers and take them down. I mean, it's interesting, even less, even n over log n is interesting. The adversary gets to control at most n over log n of the servers of the world. It's interesting. So the adversary can do that. They can do that completely adaptively, but the readers are also adaptive. They can decide where to go next based on the information that they saw before. So can you beat the lower bound for the non-adaptive case? This is the open problem. And here, LDCs are, I mean, here I really don't know the answer.
You will probably do well, right?
Yeah, everything is probabilistic. Think of your competitor as this probabilistic quorum system you described, probabilistic storage system.
So you don't want one?
No.
It's all state that it allowed.
Yeah.
So how is it different, just to understand, from batch calls?
From, remind me, batch codes? It will be similar to the, more closer to the LDC. So here, I guess, LDC is getting different. Okay, so let me finish with presenting from this work just the open problem from the work with Danny Halnick. So this is the problem. Is it possible to have an efficient procedure that is given two CNF formula for the same set of variables, and the output of this procedure is another formula that is satisfiable if and only if one of the two formulas is satisfiable, and the length, the total length, think of some reasonable encoding, is shorter than the sum of the two input formulas. So I want to start with two formulas, end up with one formula, which is shorter than the two ones. And short should be sufficiently short to apply recursively something like 1 minus epsilon times the length of the two inputs. And it should, again, I don't particularly care about the encoding here, but again, I want to be able to apply it recursively. So it should maintain itself when you apply it recursively. So this is the problem. Why are we asking this question?
Come up in polynomial time.
In polynomial time, yeah, efficient. Why are we asking the question? If you can do this thing, then you can come up with a construction of collision-resistant hash function based on any one-way function. And on the other hand, we know that there are no black box constructions of such functions from a one-way function. And the construction that we have is non-black box, of course. So this is, if you have such a procedure, then you can build a CRH from one-way function. If there is no such procedure, then there is hope for lots of things. For instance, efficient everlasting encryption in the hybrid bounded storage model for forward secure storage, that was in last crypto by Zimbowski. There is very interesting work by Dubrov, Vela Dubrov and Yuval Ishai related to de-randomization of sampling. And they have various formulations which are more win-win. This is not, I don't want to pretend here that it's exactly win-win what we have here. So this is the open problem. Is it related to LDCs? That's actually a good question. I don't know. I know that if certain aspects of the PCP reductions have certain properties, then you can get it, but it's not clear at all. Yeah?
Could you put restrictions on how big the pi thing? Just make pi 2 to 0. And you just have to make pi 1 shorter and shorter.
Pi 2?
Yeah, that's another.
This is potentially.
Which? What
if such a thing exists for pi 2 equal to 0, that would mean. Is that what
you mean? Yeah, so you just make pi 1 shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
Then.
Oh! Why are you not making it shorter and shorter? Because the number of variables could grow a bit, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
The underlying problem is not going to be easier. You're not getting an easier problem necessarily. It's shorter than the sum of the two formulas.
But if one formula is just zero, then the OR is the same formula as you started.
No, really the same formula, let's say.
That's
a
number of complexity question. Then it's a Kolmogorov complexity. Is it possible to make the smallest representation?
So I'm not interested. Well, I am, but as I said, it's not possible there. So the basic thing, let's say that they're of the same length. Okay, so here is one problem so many of the ideas we have, the natural ideas for doing these things, so this is what we want. And many of the ideas we want are rhythmically retrievable, which means that, so a natural idea for approaching this problem means that if you have a witness phi 1, then you also will get a witness for phi. Okay, given a witness for phi 1, and given phi, you will get a witness for phi as well. This is, if a reduction has this property, we call it witness retrievable. And what we can show is that if one-way functions exist, then a witness, then you cannot have this property. You cannot have a reduction which has this property. It cannot be witness retrievable. So if you want to attack this problem, you have to think of reductions which are not witness retrievable. which do not preserve the witnesses. Even if you know a witness for fee one, you would not know a witness for fee.
Fee is fee one or fee two?
Yeah, fee is fee one or fee two. Yeah, the formula that is equivalent to fee one or fee two.
So you're saying the same.
Okay.
Witness
so it shouldn't. And the natural thing, certainly if you simply write it down this way, it will be a witness. But the natural idea is if you have a witness for, let's say, for fee two, and you're given fee, then you will also have a witness for fee. I mean, certainly if it's written this way, it will be true. But the question here after the compression.
If compressibility exists, then this cannot be the case. And one-way function.
Exactly. If we believe that one-way functions exist and compressibility exists, then you cannot have this problem. And that's why it's going to be tricky to come up with compression. Maybe it's, of course, in another way to interpret it, it's an indication that there is no compression. But the way I interpret it is, if compression exists, then it's going to be tricky. So I'll end with sort of the context of this talk. I mean, this was the motivation for the work with Danny Heinig, but you could say that in general this gives a way to, in the original, this is cartoons from the Gary Johnson book, so where you had a poor guy who couldn't find an algorithm for his problem, and various approaches for dealing with NP-complete problems with NP-hard problems have been developed. But so, like approximation or average case complexity, etc. But what we're doing is suggesting our favorite approach for dealing with problems, and that's to postpone them. And the reason why we're talking about compression is, of course, we want to get rid of the clutter. Okay, thank you.